So I wanted to just give a sort of little potted introduction, skipping over a few of the technicalities, to another idea in path integrals, which goes back to Feynman, and is briefly mentioned as an example in Feynman and Hibbs. So we're playing a new game here. We're slightly looking ahead as well. We're trying to understand something about path integrals for relativistic particles. We're going to start in the simplest case where you can possibly do that. So one space, one time dimension. We're sort of taking for granted that there is an answer to be calculated, and one knows the form of the answer. But we're just going to play about with quite abstract ways of thinking how you might find a path integral way of getting towards that answer. So the new game is this. We start with continuous space and time, and then we discretize it. And we discretize it in a specific way. So we're going to pretend now that we just have isolated points. And it's as though we've taken a chessboard or a checkerboard and turned it on its edge. And never mind about the black and white squares. Yeah, but we've done something like that. So the points are just the corners of the checkerboard. This is how we're going to construct paths in this discretized space-time that go forwards in the time direction and to nearest neighbors. So you can go like this, you can go like this. But any given point, there's only really two choices. You either go that way or you go that way. And we're interested in the end in calculating propagators. So we're interested in what the amplitude is. We're going from some point, let's call it 0, 0, to some other point, let's call it xt. So, of course, our first problem is x and t are continuous coordinates. This is discrete. Maybe xt don't actually live on your checkerboard. So, for the moment, we're just going to have to deal with that and restrict attention to points that actually do live on the checkerboard. But our program is as follows. We're going to try and define a path integral for the discretized checkerboard and then take the limit as the size of these elementary steps gets smaller and smaller. So our idea is that we're going to approximate the continuum better and better by scaling down and down and down and down. So that in the end, we let me bring that down just for a minute again. At the end, we could get at least arbitrarily close to any point xt in space and time. So I'm not giving you any fundamental justification for doing this. It's just an idea. We're gonna play with it and see where it goes. So another thing we're going to do, and again, we're looking ahead a little bit. The motivation, to understand the motivation for this, you need to understand about the Dirac equation in 2D. But let's just take it as on faith for the moment. We're going to separate out the cases where the particle starts at 0, 0 and goes this way, so to the right, from the case where it goes this way, to the left. And we're also going to separate out the corresponding two cases about its arrival. So it can either arrive at xt from this point or from this point. It's either coming in from the right or coming in from the left. So we've actually got we're going to split up our set of all paths into sets of paths that start out left, end up left, left, right, right, left, right, right, and so on. So we're actually going to have four different subsets of paths. That will turn out to be the natural thing to do, but let's just accept it for the moment. Okay, so we've set out a program. We haven't yet given any rule for how to calculate the amplitude for an individual path. I'm going to have to flip back and forward a little bit. But we're going to, again, pluck out of thin air some rule. Here it is, in this purple box here. We're going to assign to a path an amplitude that depends only on one thing. It depends on how many times it switches direction in going from the start point to the end point. So we've got to switch there, 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 and so on. There will be a total of, let's call it R turns. And for a path of that form, we're going to give an amplitude of I epsilon m to the R, where epsilon is the parameter of the spacing of this, the size of the spacing of this lattice. Okay, well, I could play whatever game I like. We can play whatever game we like. We have some rules here. How many things could go wrong with this program? Does anybody have any suggestions for ways in which this could turn out to either not to give an answer at all, or not to give a answer that makes any physical sense? Yep.
Random walking or
is that a problem or just an interesting observation? I mean, you're absolutely right. This looks, at least formally, rather like a sort of an analysis of random walks, except, of course, we've got a complex number of the amplitude associated.
There's no way you add random walk. If you want to arrive at B, you can't go past some point.
Oh, sure. It's as though we're analyzing random walks, but we're focusing on the subset of the random walks that satisfy our constraints, start point and end point, as we always do in the path integral. So certainly, there's something. Reminiscent of random walk analyses about these. That isn't necessarily a problem. I mean, it might just be interesting. Can anybody think of things that we really have to worry about? After all, you could play this game, you could play any game, something like this for yourselves. You could say, I'm going to dream up some rule about paths and amplitudes. Try some way of understanding the continuum in terms of a discrete approximation. What sort of things might you worry about in advance?
Why convergence?
Well, yeah, very good, thank you. I guess even step further back, if it converges, this is something that's not at all obvious. We're taking a limit in which this gap gets smaller and smaller towards space-time. We've got absolutely no guarantee in advance that we'll get an answer that makes any sense in that limit. Maybe it will just blow up to infinity and give us something useless. So that's That's definitely a big worry, and we're going to have to look into that. Anything else that could go wrong that would tell us that physically this wasn't a sensible idea after all, it couldn't be a sensible calculation. I mean, we're trying, in a babyish sort of way maybe, but we're trying to get insight into how two physical theories are connected, quantum mechanics and special relativity. And we've followed an intuition that came from looking at path integrals in quantum mechanics, and now we're playing a little game in which relativity's come into the picture. Is there any concern about our treatment of relativity in this. Yep?
You're not really treating time and space the same way. So you're
because
not really respecting the... I don't know. You're not really respecting special relativity very much. That's where you
want to go. That's it. That's certainly a sort of, there is a worry there. Are we respecting special relativity properly? I don't know. Maybe it depends on exactly how you frame it, whether it's really to do with whether we're treating time and space together. But here's something that we've definitely done. We've actually implicitly picked out a coordinate frame in setting up our checkerboard. And we're going to take a limit, but it's basically going to use the same coordinate frame. So look, we're really saying when we do this, there are these lines here which pick out time delta t to delta t. 3 delta t. And so, which is selected by the geometry that we've set up here. So this is not a Lorentz invariant construction. We've imposed something non-Lorentz invariant on one plus one-dimensional space-time. And an obvious worry is that as a result of that, we're not going to get a Lorentz invariant answer. It turns out that it worked. We'll see the extent to which it works out. But we should say, any time one's dealing with a symmetry, and in particular any time you're trying to model special or general relativity, if you start playing games involving approximating space and time, you should certainly worry about this. You're likely to run in at least to questions, maybe problems about whether your formulation of the problem is actually respective of the symmetries of the theory. Okay. So we're interested in getting an expression for the propagator from A to B. We can write down the coordinates there. But another way of thinking about this, given the checkerboard that we've set up, is that there's a certain number of diagonal steps. So let's call them P and Q that take us from A to B. We have, let's see, we're also interested in the sum and the difference of those. So let's call those N and M. N is the sum, M is the difference. And there's some obvious geometric constraint on M in terms of X. And then the space coordinates, XB, X minus A, well, that's P minus Q, M times the parameter epsilon that's the scale of this lattice. And the time difference is P plus Q, in other words, N times epsilon. So our next problem is to try and think about all the ways that you can get along this checkerboard from A to B. Does anybody have an idea of how you'd at least start to approach that as what's now really a mathematical problem? Let's think for a minute. Here's a general path, and we're interested really in its zigs and its zags. So, and we're interested in paths with some particular number of zigzags, a total of r turns. So the first thing is, well, you can only, there's a sort of parity here. If you flip left, then your next flip's got to be the right, and then left, and then right, and so on. So you've got to have essentially the same number of turns to the left, and then to the right. Whether it's precisely the same number depends whether you're starting and ending up in the same direction. So let's take the case here, which you start to the right and you end up coming in, moving to the left. Well, then you're going to need to turn R one more time to the left than you do to the right. And the only way that can work is that somewhere on this line you make a left turn. So your final left turn is constrained to be on this line. Apart from that, if you make R turns, well, they're split equally between the right and the left, and they can happen on any of these lines in the rectangle and any of these lines in the rectangle. So, and it doesn't matter where they happen for our expression for the amplitude of the path. The expression only depends on the total number of turns. So if we're trying to work out how the contribution from all paths with R turns, we've reduced this to an essentially combinatorial problem. You have a total of q steps this way, and you've got to select R minus 1 over 2 points, which define the left terms, and you've got a total of p steps this way, and you've got to select R minus 1 over 2 points that define the right terms. So this is the thing we need to focus on, the number of paths with a total of R terms times the amplitude for each of them. And as I said, it reduces to pure combinatorics. You have p minus 1 places where you can make this choice of turn, and you've got to pick out half R minus 1. So we get this choose function, p minus 1 factorial over half R minus 1 factorial times p minus 1 minus half R minus 1 factorial. And similarly, for the other term, it might be q. It's, again, a matter of R minus 1 over 2 arbitrary choices. And if you think about that a little bit more, let's suppose that these numbers p and q are large, so the sum and difference, m and n. And let's focus on some particular class with a fixed value of r. Well, as these terms get large, as p and q get large, take that expression on the left here, p minus 1 factorial over half r minus 1 factorial p minus 1 minus a half r minus 1 all factorial. Let's keep that and look at the ratio of these two things. Well, that's really just p minus 1 times p minus 2 down to p minus a half r minus 1 plus 1 all over half r minus 1 factorial. And if p is a lot larger than r, these terms are essentially all p minus 1 plus times small factors that we're going to approximate to 1. So this is just p minus 1, and again, same approximation, we might as well call it p, to the half r minus 1 over half r minus 1 factorial to leading order, and similarly the other one, q to the half r minus 1 over half r minus 1 factorial to leading order. Okay. So I really want to sort of give this some of the spirit of this calculation without necessarily going through every last step, which you can certainly work through for yourselves later. We have this expression, and now we have to work out the propagator by summing over different values of R. This expression, remember, was for some fixed value of the number of terms. But our amplitude is defined by all the paths with variable number of terms. Each of those gets an I epsilon m to the R. And then we have this thing that we've just, at least a leading order, calculated, the number of paths with the fixed value of R. And now, look, we've got an expression here, P times Q. Remember, P was n minus m, Q is n plus m. And we could rewrite this in terms of x and t as just n over 2 gamma squared, where gamma is the relativistic correction factor corresponding to the speed that a particle would go if it followed a path uniformly from 0, 0 to xt. So just because we have n squared minus m squared, we essentially pick up a 1 minus x squared over t squared term here. And that's the first hint that this thing might actually be all right as far as Lorentz covariance is concerned. We're picking up factors that actually look covariant. So we can incorporate that factor here and rewrite things in terms of t over gamma. And you'll notice another way of writing t over gamma is just the proper time, t squared minus x squared to the half, between the start and the end, the start and the end point of our path. So a little more work, which you might want to work through for yourselves. I encourage you to do so. Persuades us that the approximations we made are all valid, and the reason for that is, even though the number of possible paths is going to get exponentially large as n gets small, the paths that give the dominant contributions actually come from paths with a relatively small number of bends. And that number, that characteristic number, doesn't actually change in the limit as this mesh gets smaller and smaller. So that's maybe an a priori slightly surprising fact. It's not that hard to verify from the algebra. It just drops out of it. A little bit more work still, and we can evaluate that whole sum exactly and find that it in fact simplifies to a Bessel function in the limit as n tends to infinity. And then more work still, and that will have to be postponed. One could check that indeed this is the right thing. This is the propagator for the relativistic wave equation in 1+1 dimensions. For part of it's one of the four propagators, I should say. Because it turns out we need to deal with an object with two different components rather than one. So I want to focus on the spirit of what this doesn't teach us. We've already seen, we messed up special relativity. We broke Lorentz invariance when we set up the checkerboard. And yet we find it comes back. We recover it in the continuum limit. We didn't have any guarantee in advance that would work, and it's very interesting that it does. And it's worth, two things worth keeping in mind. You better worry about it, and yet it might work out in other contexts. Sometimes you have to break a symmetry to do calculations and then find that you nonetheless recover it at the end of the calculations. It's intriguing, and I think, to be honest, it was sort of reverse engineered. It's intriguing that this algebraically very simple rule for path amplitudes actually gives the right answer. It seems very ad hoc. It's hard to think, we don't really have a physical principle that tells us this is the right way of thinking about the behavior of Dirac particles in 1+1. We've actually got something here that we've been worrying about in other contexts. in this simple, almost toy case, that at least we actually do have a rigorous definition of a path integral as a continuum limit. And it helps, of course, that we explicitly restricted ourselves to paths of a particular form, paths in which the particle, point by point, is always going in a light-like direction, along a light ray. It helps in the sense that that gives us a much smaller set of paths than one that turns out to have a fine limit here. Let's remind ourselves, let's notice again. If we think of this as telling us what the particle is really doing between A and B, we run into immediate trouble. These amplitudes are either complex numbers, they can be positive, but they can also be negative, they can also be pure imaginary. We don't have a probability interpretation of these paths either. And another way in which they sort of rather confound our intuition is we actually calculate the propagator for a massive particle, and yet all the paths that are used to build up the expression for that propagator look as though they're describing the behavior of a massless particle. They're describing something that's, except when it's turning, traveling at light speed in one direction or another. And then a final, slightly sort of wistful comment. It would be great to be able to say this extends to 3 plus 1D and beyond. At the moment, we can't say that. This seems to be very special to the 1 plus 1D case. There'd be lots, not surprisingly, lots of attempts to generalize it's 3 plus 1D, and they're interesting attempts, but it looks still natural only in the 1 plus 1D case. It gets a little bit baroque once you try and press it beyond that. Okay, we're almost at the end of our discussion of half integrals for the moment. So just a couple more remarks. Remember, we've been looking at paths in space and time, but nothing in quantum mechanics tells us the position is a special variable. We could have worked with momentum. We could work with other variables. We need to keep that in mind. Second, the metaphor of the path integral, despite the difficulty in pinning down exactly what it means, is one that many people in many contexts have found very useful, very powerful, very good way of feeding your intuition and trying to think, perhaps even slightly loosely, about what could actually happen. For example, some of the pioneers of quantum computing were inspired by this notion that one way of thinking about what you're doing in a quantum computer is carrying out the computation along a series of quantum paths in parallel, and then measuring the output. Remember, we can't look at these paths individually. We have to carry out this measurement at the end, just as if we do a two-slit experiment. We don't get to find out what the amplitude of each individual path in the interferometer is. We only get to see an interference pattern at the end. Despite that, quantum computing turns out to be, in some important problems, far more powerful than classical. And then there's a little conceptual confusion that I think we should guard against right from the start. People often talk rather loosely about the path integral and the idea of many worlds quantum theory as though they're basically the same thing. But they're really not. Whether they both or neither or partly turn out to be valid, they're conceptually quite different ideas. So the path integral talks about mathematical, non-physical constructs that lead from A to B and interfere. Everett's idea of many worlds quantum theory wasn't about purely mathematical constructs, but about real, effectively independent, branching worlds, as real as the one that we seem to find ourselves in. And although in principle it's true they could reinterfere, in practice, if this idea makes sense at all, they all essentially almost never actually do. Whether Everett's idea works out or not, well, that's a whole other can of worms. It's another controversial question, and let's leave that to one side for now. But at any rate, let's separate those two. Any more questions on path integrals before I move on? Or in anything so far? Yeah?
Can I ask you a quick question about this checkerboard?
Yeah.
So we imposed from the start that it can't go faster, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how much of special relativity do we have already imposed by here? Is there any sense in which you constructed it to be compatible with special relativity?
That part of the rule, I guess, is sort of inspired by special relativity, isn't it? You shouldn't go outside the future light cone. Even there, you're sort of dicing with the rules because, you've got a massive particle and yet you're allowing it to travel along light rays. You're using some relativistic insights in order to develop this model. At the same time, we did explicitly break Lorentz invariance in setting up the checkerboard. Yep.
Could you go back to the sign with the largest contribution to the past?
This one or the
yes.
Mathematical one?
So the most contributions come from the least number of sense?
Not the least number, but the contributions for zero bends typically will be smaller than one, which will be smaller than two. But it sort of behaves like this. Wrong board. Number of bends. Don't really take anything about this graph very seriously except the maximum point. And the decay. So this is actually exactly z. M tau. And that's the maximum point. I remember propagating from 0, 0 to xt. So tau is some fixed number with the proper time along that path, and m is some fixed number. It's the mass. So this point where we get the maximum is independent of the size of the mesh. It's independent of n, the number of paths. OK, so that's the statement. Now, you had a question about the statement? Why?
Just wondering what you mean by you get larger contributions from bent paths that doesn't bend much?
It turns out that, indeed. Don't bend much, meaning they have a finite number of, a particular finite number of zigzags.
Because with a bend, you mean there's, for example, right and then left.
Yeah, so although our checkerboard gets smaller and smaller, the only thing you can do if you're going to bend is switch abruptly from going at light speed to the right to light speed at the left, or vice versa. That's the way we've set things up.
Because I was thinking if you want a small amount of bends, it would just go there and then one bend. To the left. So a lot of right steps, and then one bend, and a lot of left steps.
Lots of right steps, one bend, lots of left steps.
Yeah.
Like that.
So would that give a large contribution or a small contribution?
That's only an individual path, so we'd have. I guess it's also true that's the only way to get from there to there with one bend. That will give a smallish. But that's, let's be clear on the nomenclature. This is a path with one bend. So it's sitting somewhere here in this. Well, but I'm summing, this is summing over I should say that. Size of contribution for all paths. With R bends. And so this is R is the number of bends. We're summing over a whole class of paths in plotting this graph.
And the maximum will correspond to the number of bends it would take to go approximately as straight from CR to
CR. Approximately straight?
As straight as possible. Like it's really line two. Would that correspond to the maximum?
I kind of guess not, actually. That's an interesting question. I like the intuition. But the idea would be if you're below the line, whenever you can, you bend until you get above it. And then whenever you can, you bend until you get below it again. Yeah? So my trying to think about the geometry here. My hunch is that it's hard to think of your feet, I suppose. My hunch is that will involve an awful lot of bends, actually, as the limit gets. For x equals 0, for instance, it would be bending all the time. Thank you. That's an obvious case. Very good. Okay, so no, that's not what they're doing. They're not getting close to as close to the straight line as they can. I see the intuition here, that you might think that's what they should be doing, but
does it mean that in this model, the classical path isn't a stationary point? And you would guess that the stationary point has to be the one that gives you the biggest contribution.
Interesting.
It's not subclass, it's sum over classes of classes. You don't sum each class as equal.
No, but I mean the equivalent of action in this case. It somehow seems reasonable to think that
it looks as right. So what we concluded unrigorously about the non-relativistic case was the total amplitude was given by a sum over a class of things very close to the classical part. That doesn't seem to be true in this model, indeed. Which is interesting. What to do with it? Well, we weren't even sure what to do with the observation. Yeah.
If we want to calculate the absolute chance, I mean normalized chance, what should we do to find the particle at x and t?
We need to work out the total amplitude and then take the mod squared of that.
Is it possible?
Yes. It looks a bit of a mess from the presentation here, but it turns out in the end to give actually quite simple functions. Yeah. Okay. So enough.
One more.
Nearly enough. One more.
Because I think you can have an intuition about it. Because just take the easiest case where you want to go straight up.
Okay.
Then 6 second cross gives only one path.
Yep.
Taking the largest path also gives
only two paths. Yep.
So if you go somewhere in between, you have lots of paths to sum over.
Right.
So that's probably why it gets.
So there's certainly a tension, isn't there, between the number of paths in a class and the fact that we've got this scale factor that includes an epsilon to the R. Those two are competing, and that's why we don't get a monotonic behavior in either direction here. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Let's move to another topic. And let me remind you, this is actually a copy of something we've already looked at, just to motivate it. We already looked at the time evolution operator, u of t, as an exponential of I minus iht over h bar. And we saw that it was useful to think about the infinitesimal version of that, in which epsilon is small. We can obtain the generator from the small epsilon behavior of the unitary operator. We saw it defines a group with a natural composition law, which is just this additive law here. So now I want to think more generally about this sort of groups acting in physics, these sort of symmetries. Let me say something that looks pretty dumb. With all the time in this discussion here, we're working with H time independent. I could phrase what we've just said as evolving forward in time itself defines a symmetry of the system. So time is really going this way. But I'm going to introduce a second parameter, let's call it S, and just see what happens. So if I take my state, psi 0, and then push forward to S, time S, and then evolve in time by time t. Well, e to the minus I s over h bar, e to the minus h t over h bar, that's just going to give me psi of S plus t. And I could have done this another way around. I could first take the initial state, evolve it forwards in time, and then apply this fictitious second time evolution, e to the minus s over h bar. So I have a pretty trivial example of a diagram that commutes. And it commutes because of this expression. And if you really want to be pedantic about it, why does that work? E to the minus I hs over h bar, e to the minus I h t over h bar. Well, Baker Campbell Hausdorff tells us that that's e to the minus I s plus t over h bar plus a term that involves the commutator of these two things. So hh times stuff plus higher order terms that also involve commutators. And h commutes with itself, so those terms all vanish. And well, I did say this was going to look dumb. So one way of thinking about it, though, is that this diagram commutes because of this identity. Let's abstract from that. We've got some symmetry of the physics. We can either evolve in time and then apply our symmetry operator, or we can apply the symmetry operator and then evolve in time, and it doesn't matter which way around we do it. This equals this. So what does that tell us? Well, that tells us if this is genuinely a symmetry, it should work for any initial state psi 0. We need this identity to hold for all psi 0, and we also need it to, for any time interval t that we choose to evolve over. Take the inner product with psi and multiply by e to the plus I h t. Actually, the other way around. Multiply by e to the plus I h t, then take the inner product with psi. That gives us this identity. And this is still true for all t and for all psi. So we must have an operator identity. This equals this. We also see the expectation value of S in the state psi doesn't change. This is the expectation value of time 0. This is the expectation value of time t. They're the same thing. In other words, this thing S is conserved. What do we really mean by that? Well, let's develop the formalism a little bit further. We could, at this level of discussion, be talking about any sort of symmetry. We could be talking about reflections in space, for instance, the parity symmetry. And that would be, if we have a situation, say, in one, 1D with a symmetric potential, that would be a perfectly appropriate thing to discuss, and we would indeed have a commuting diagram like that. But we're more interested in the case analogous to the one of time evolution, where we have a whole continuous family of symmetries. At least for the moment, we're more interested in that case. So we have symmetries of the form e to the I a s. A is Hermitian, s is real, and we have a commutative diagram like so. And so an identity involving these two exponentials. And now our use of Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff isn't quite so trivial. These two things commute. BCH tells us that will be true if A commutes with H. And we also see if A commutes with H, then I can just pull this operator right through A and cancel with this operator, so I get this identity. So I see, indeed, that the expectation value of A, the generator of the symmetry, is constant for all, in any state psi. And so A itself is also, and really more interestingly for us, a conserved quantity. The expectation doesn't change under time evolution. So, if we have a, you could run this argument this way. If you have a conserved quantity, this must be true, and this must be true, and this must be true, and so you indeed have a continuous family of symmetries. Let's just check again that we can run it both ways from first principles. So, suppose we do have a continuous family of symmetries parameterized by S, and suppose they indeed define a group with the composition law, which is just additive in the parameters. S of T is S of S plus T. S of 0 is the identity. I guess that follows from the composition law. Well, we wanted to map normalized states to normalized states. So here's normalized state psi. We want S of S psi also to be normalized. We must have this identity holding. And that tells us that S stagger times S, since this has to be true for all states psi, has to be the identity. But we already, from the composition law, know another way to invert S of S. S of S times S of minus S is the identity. So these two things must be the same. S stagger is just S. S dagger of S is just S of minus S. And now if we take S small, S epsilon, well, let's write it as 1 plus I epsilon A for some operator A without assuming anything about the operator. We must have some expression like this, since S of 0 is the identity, and we're thinking this is a continuous family, and so there must be some way to continuously approximate its behavior near the identity. Well, S dagger is just 1 minus I epsilon A dagger. But we've got this general relationship between S dagger of S and S of minus S. We apply it to the case little s equals epsilon. We know that S dagger epsilon is S of minus epsilon, which is the identity minus I epsilon times A. So we have another thing falling out of this. A is Hermitian, A equals A dagger. So if we have a continuous family, we must be able to pull out a Hermitian operator, in other words, a physical observable, that generates it and that is a conserved quantity. If we have a continuous family of symmetries, we can find a conserved quantity that's generating it. And then just to sort of complete the abstract level of the discussion, if we look at the composition law in the case where we have one large parameter and one arbitrarily small one, then S of epsilon is approximately 1 plus I epsilon. A up to terms that are of order smaller than epsilon. So ds by ds is given by the limit of these things, which just gives us I times s times a. So we have a differential equation, which actually is formally exactly the same as the one we got for the time evolution law. And again, we can just write down the solution. S of s is e to the I a s. So our symmetry group is generated by the Hermitian operator, not just in the sense that near the identity, S of epsilon looks like e to the I a epsilon, but everywhere. S of s is e to the I a s. Hermitian operator is conserved. It's generating the group, and our relationship is complete. So what are examples of this? Well, we've already noticed one of them. The Hamiltonian generates the symmetry of time translation, which applies in the case where we have a time-independent potential. What if we have a potential that's translation-independent in space? For example, for a single particle, what if we have a trivial potential? Then the momentum commutes with the Hamiltonian. There's no V term in the Hamiltonian that would cause a non-zero commutator. The momentum is a conserved quantity. It generates symmetries e to the IPS over H bar. And what do they do? Well, let's stick with the case of a single particle and look at its wave function. If I apply e to the IPS over H bar to the wave function psi of s, we know the we could write P is minus I h bar d by dx. So this is just e to the s d by dx applied to psi of x. And write out the exponential explicitly. That's 1 plus s d by dx plus and so on. And that's just giving us the Taylor series for psi of x plus s in term expanded about psi of x. In other words, the symmetry that's being generated by the momentum is exactly the symmetry of spatial translation. We had the particle here, and we've moved it over there, but kept the shape of the wave function invariant. We want to think a little bit more about another interesting case that sort of follows naturally from the one we just looked at. Rotations in 3D. So let's suppose we have a rotationally symmetric potential. For instance, in the approximation in which the nucleus of the hydrogen atom is fixed, the potential, the electrostatic potential that it, that an electron experiences from it. Then we have a rotationally invariant Hamiltonian H, and we have a continuous symmetry that's actually rather larger than the ones we've looked at so far. We have rotations in 3D. And if I choose any particular axis, I can find an infinite one-parameter family of rotations. But there are independent axes in 3D. I certainly have something bigger than a single one-parameter family of rotations. So take a general rotation. It's going to send psi of x to psi of the rotated vector x. Here's x, we rotate, goes over there. And this must be, the action of this by assumption is commuting with the Hamiltonian. So let's pick one particular axis. Let's take the z-axis and look at rotations around that axis. We know if you rotate through an angle alpha, you're going to change the x and y coordinates and leave the z coordinates invariant. So this thing is implicitly acting on the vector x, y, z. We just have a familiar 2D rotation in x and y given by this 2 by 2 matrix. And if we look at the case where alpha is infinitesimal, that's basically 1 minus epsilon 1 plus higher order terms. So we're interested in the generator of the symmetry. We need to look at the term that differentiates this from the identity. This is the identity plus this matrix. Just to recap, a small rotation about the z-axis is given by the identity plus epsilon times this matrix plus order epsilon squared. What's that doing? It's sending x to x plus epsilon y and y to y minus epsilon x. Never mind the identity bit of that. This term is just sending x to minus y, y to x, and it's doing nothing at all to z. So the differential operator that does that is just y d by dx minus x d by dy. And that's actually a familiar thing. That's the component of angular momentum in the z direction up to the factor minus I h bar. So we see another already physically familiar operator that's generating symmetries for us. In this case, the rotational symmetries about the z-axis are being generated by the z component of angular momentum. And actually, we don't really have to stop our discussion with the order epsilon analysis. I can expand out cos and sine like so. And you notice that another way of writing that is as a power series really everything is just in, all that's happening is in this 2x2 block. It's really a power series in this 2x2 rotation matrix like this. And it's just the exponential. It's another way of saying e to the I theta is cos theta plus I sine theta. So we can get an exact expression for rz of epsilon as the exponential of e to the minus I epsilon over h bar lz. It's not just a leading order expression. And also, this power series actually converges not just for small epsilon, but for any value of epsilon. So in fact, what we've derived is a general expression consistent with what we've expected from our previous discussion for rotations through any angle, any finite angle alpha, about the z-axis, as e to the minus I alpha over h bar times z component of angular momentum. Often, you've probably seen this done another way, as well as or instead of this way. Often this discussion is carried out by moving to spherical polar coordinates and then writing LZ like so, and noticing that everything follows quite slickly from that. And that's fine, but I quite like the fact that it's also straightforward from the definitions to do this discussion directly in Cartesian coordinates. Well, obviously, there was nothing special about the z-axis, so we could just as well write down the rotations about the x or the y-axis in terms of the generators of angular momentum about those. And of course, there's nothing special either about our particular choice of Cartesian frame. So really what we have is an expression for a rotation about an arbitrary axis defined by some unit vector. Is that one? Through some arbitrary angle in terms of the relevant linear combination of the components of angular momentum defined by the unit vector. So again, L is given by the cross product of X and P. I'm going to want to use more than one notation. Sometimes you ought to talk about X, Y, Z. Sometimes it's more convenient to use coordinates X1, X2, X3. And now is about that time. So let's just notice that. So we can understand everything about the action of the rotation group on wave functions in terms of the action of the operators Lx, Ly, Z, and linear combinations of those operators. What else can we say about those operators? Well, in this x1, x2, x3 notation, we have the commutator between the ith component of momentum, the jth component of position, just as either 0 or minus ih bar, depending whether I equals j or not. These are just, from which it swiftly follows that we have a commutation relation between Li and Lj of the form ih bar I epsilon I j k l k. I'm assuming everybody is familiar with this notation of epsilons, deltas, and the Einstein summation convention. Stop me right now if you're not. Okay, good. So it turns out to be interesting to look at the operator L squared, which is just this thing. What's its commutator with Lj? A little bit of work, and then noticing that we've got an anti-symmetric thing here in Jk, and something that's symmetric, sorry, in Ik, and something here that's symmetric in Ik, swiftly persuades us that this operator L squared commutes with Lj. So we could pick out at least any one of the Ljs. Conventionally, we're going to pick L3, the Z component, and find simultaneous eigenstates of L squared and that component, since these things commute. To get any further, it's useful to look at particular combinations of the other components. So I want to look at these non-Hermitian operators, L plus or minus, which are L1 plus or minus IL2. And you'll notice, of course, L1 and L2 are Hermitian. So if I take the dagger of L plus, for instance, I just flip the sign here and I get L minus, and vice versa. L squared commutes with all the components of angular momentum, and these are just linear combinations. So L squared commutes with L plus or minus. What about L3? It doesn't commute. If you look at L3, the bracket of L3 with L plus or minus, well, the L3 with L1 will produce an IH bar L2. The L3 with L2 will produce plus or minus H bar L1. We've got an I there already. So we end up rewriting that in a particularly concise way. We end up with the commutator of L3 with L plus or minus is plus or minus H bar times L plus or minus. Okay, so now we'd already agreed that we can simultaneously diagonalize L squared and L3, so since they commute. So let's suppose we've got some state that's a simultaneous eigenstate of both. I'm going to, I think it's familiar to most of you, but if it weren't, I'm going to write this eigen relation in a slightly, what might seem a slightly peculiar way. L squared psi, let's parameterize this as L L plus 1 times H bar squared psi. I can write, if I've got any real number, I can find an L for which it's L L plus 1, so I'm not making any further assumption by writing it that way. And let's just call the eigenvalue of psi for L3 M times H bar. So these raising and lower ordering operators are so named for a good reason, of course. If we look at the if we look at the state L plus or minus psi and the action of L squared on that state, well, since this commutes, modulo a little error, we have do this in real time. Let's see. L plus or minus psi is also an eigenstate of L squared with the same eigenvalue. It hasn't changed. It hasn't changed the product L plus one. Therefore, the number L. On the other hand, L3 doesn't commute with L plus or minus. We have this commutation relation. And so it does, it still gives us an eigenstate if psi was an eigenstate of L3, but it's an eigenstate with a different eigenvalue. The raising and lowering operators raise, surprise, surprise, or lower the value of M by plus or minus 1. So, we have this relation here. What else can we say about the states we can make from psi by applying raising and lowering operators? Well, let's take the raising operator L plus applied to psi and look at its norm. L plus dagger is L minus, so this is just the inner product of psi with L minus L plus psi. Write that out more explicitly. That's quadratic expression involving L1 and L2. And you see we get an L1 squared term and an L2 squared term. And then we have these two things in different orders, so we end up with a commutator term, i.e. times the commutator of L1, L2. Well, L squared was just the sum of all three components squared. So this is L squared minus L3 squared. And the commutator is, again, proportional to L3. So what do we have? L squared, the eigenvalue of psi under L squared is just L, L plus 1. This term will give us a minus M squared. This term will give us a minus M. There's an overall factor of H bar squared. Putting that together, we get this useful expression, L, L plus 1 minus M, M plus 1. So the norm, this norm here is given by this numerical factor multiplying the norm squared of psi. So if psi is non-zero, and I guess we want to start with some physical state, so we're going to assume psi is indeed non-zero, we have a non-trivial constraint here. The norm squared of L plus psi has to be greater than zero if this is a real physical state. And the only other possibility, logically, is that it equals zero. It just cannot be less than zero. We don't. We have nothing in the Hilbert space which is allowed to have negative norm. So for this to be greater than or equal to zero, we need L, L plus 1 is greater than or equal to M, M plus 1. And, that's, if you think about that as a quadratic equation in M, it's easy to see that M, therefore, has to lie in the range between minus L and L. Okay, well, that's actually a useful constraint. We didn't a priori know that there was any relationship between the eigenvalues, size eigenvalue under L squared and under M. And now we have one. But notice that it tells us something more than that. If we apply L3 to L plus psi, we find that L plus psi is an eigenstate of L3 with the raised eigenvalue M plus 1 times the factor of H bar. If I apply L plus squared to psi, I've raised it again, so it's now M plus 2 H bar, the value, and so on. So if I can keep on playing this game, if I can start with psi, apply L plus again, I will keep on raising the value of M. And although M, we've learned, has to be in this range, I'm going to sooner or later burst out of this range just by pushing M up higher and higher by applying L plus as often as it takes. So the only way to avoid that logical contradiction is for this process to terminate before we burst out of this range. We must have that for sufficiently large N. I don't, in fact, make a physical state, I don't make a non-zero state, I kill the state psi by applying L plus to the N on it. Okay, so because this factor can never be allowed to become negative, this must be the case. And if you look a little more at with a little more thought about this ladder, we start with eigenvalue m h bar, raise, and that gives us m plus 1 h bar, and so on, m plus n h bar. There must be some state that's some value of n for which this process terminates, the state is killed. But this calculation tells us that can only happen when this factor is precisely zero. So we know when that's got to happen. It's got to happen when we started with m and we raised it to the point that the eigenvalue is now L. In other words, M plus N here equals L. And we can go the other way, of course. Instead of raising the eigenvalue by applying L plus, we can lower it by applying L minus. And we run essentially the same argument, just reflected. So L minus to the N, there must be some N value N prime, such that L minus to the N prime kills psi. And more than that, just as m plus n had to equal plus l, m minus n prime has to equal minus l. So we've actually got a much more detailed relationship between m and l than seemed evident at first sight. M has to lie somewhere in this range such that if I apply the raising operator an integer number of times, I hit L. And if I apply the lowering operator an integer number of times, I hit minus L. So M has to differ from both L and minus L by a positive integer. And that can only work if the difference between L and minus L is itself an integer. So it tells us that 2 times L has to be a positive integer. L, therefore, has to be half a positive integer, half a non-negative integer, I guess I should say, to be precise. That is almost, but not quite, all that we can extract from this little bit of the calculation. The rotation group, as we've been looking so far, is acting on position space wave functions. And so we find one further constraint. If I look at psi of a rotation on x, that's e to the minus I alpha over h bar lz acting on psi of x. That's going to give me e to the minus alpha m psi of x, where m is the eigenvalue under lz. What if I rotate through 2 pi around the z-axis? I haven't changed the coordinates at all. I've applied the identity operator as far as the action on physical coordinates x, y, z is concerned. So psi, I've just mapped the position space wave function to the same thing. For that to be the case, given this, it must be, we must have that e to the minus 2 pi I times m is 1. In other words, m has to be an integer. So let's just flip back and forward momentarily. M lies in this range. M has to be an integer. All the numbers in this range differ from L by integers. Therefore, L, it's, L also has to be an integer. So we already showed that L has to be half a non-negative integer. And now we see, by this argument, we could throw away all the non-integer values here, a half, three halves, and so on. And we're left with L non-negative integer, M also an integer, and M in the range minus L to L. Okay. I suspect this is familiar to most of you, but it's important to keep everybody together here. And it's you know, no matter how many times one sees it, it's a rather mathematically nice argument. So I hope it was worth reviewing. I want to go on to talk about spin next time, but this is probably a good place to stop here. Are there any questions on this, or any questions in general before we wrap it up for today? Okay, so same time tomorrow.